Hey now, welcome to the Dirty Side of the Track, America's leading Formula One podcast. I'm Brian, that's Rob. We were hoping to bring you an Imola recap. Obviously that didn't happen, but we are still excited you're listening, and we got some good stuff to talk about, right, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, let's hit the big news straight out the gate. I mean, it was obvious come Tuesday, I think, that there really shouldn't be a race. And all the cynics out there were kind of, me included, were like, yeah, they're going to wait. You know, they want to make some money. Maybe they don't want to refund all the tickets. So maybe they'll waive Thursday and Friday, maybe even Saturday, and we'll have some mad Sunday where they try and do quali and the race just so they can get it in. But do you know what? I'm happy to eat a big slice of humble pie and say FIA made a good call and an early one.
Yeah.
Just
Excellent.
To say, yeah, there's no point trying to divert emergency services to trying to shepherd in international superstars to come in and watch a race when there's all that crap going down. So no, good call. Good call. Very disappointed not to be doing an Imola review right now, but totally the right call to have canceled.
I mean, the first responders need to focus on people who had their life in jeopardy, not to worry about shepherding the GP to happen, you know,
exactly.
in the town. So it was a great call early. Well done. I don't think anybody would disagree. And if they do, then they're idiots.
Yeah, and do you know what?
I'm borrowing a Fernando because I got a Fernando thought coming up here a bit. So I'm getting my Fernando groove on. But yeah, I'm happy they did that early.
I am. But do you know what? It's like any good deed, there's always somebody that will take an angle and kind of say, oh, yeah, but blah, 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 blah. So I saw that FIA and Ferrari, in fact, both donated $1 million to the cause, right, to kind of help out. And I saw some coverage was kind of, well, you know, the FIA's footprint from running F1 for a year in terms of climate impact probably led to the whole flooding in the first
place. Oh, geez, really?
It's only right that they should be donating $1 million. In fact, it probably should be $1 million every year, not just this one-off token gesture. I'm like, oh, my God. Oh, my God.
This is why we can't have nice things.
Yeah, 100%, yeah. So I picked up a little thing this week, which I think, well, talking about the Fernando groove, I'm not sure you're fully on board with, but
no.
There was an interview on the F1.com. I don't know if it's because I'm an F1 TV subscriber, but it's behind the F1 Unlocked. Ooh, drum roll.
And I'm an F1 TV subscriber, too. We both have paywall access now?
If you go onto the F1 website, there'll be a lot of articles. If you don't log in, when you hit there, you'll see a lot of things that are behind this thing called F1 Unlocked, and you have to sign in to unlock them. And I don't know if that's you need F1 TV or you just need to be a registered user on the website. Who knows? But anyway, that bit's really not that important, Brian. But I got onto this interview with Stroll talking about his interview with Alonso, and it really struck a nerve. It was like really sincere. He's kind of talking about Fernando in all these like great mentorship type roles and how he's really kind of helping Lance get the most out of his driving career, and he seems to be a real team player. And I'm like, what the hell is going on here? We've been joking for a while, like, will the real Fernando please stand up? Because like, he's the bad guy and we're just waiting for him to cause Aston Martin to explode, because he tends to leave all teams in a trail of fire.
He does.
I know he does. So I'm just pitching it out there. Maybe you don't agree, but are we seeing Fernando hit the whole, like, Sebastian Vettel was not seen as a good guy all the time. Everyone loves him at the end of his career. But actually earlier on, especially with the multi-21 or whatever with old Webber, he was a bit of a, well, he's an ass.
Yeah.
Because he was a winner and he was a competitor, but you never saw him as a mentor. And then he aged and matured really nicely into this mentor to Mick. And we saw a lot of nice Mick Seb moments. I think we might be getting there with Fernando, that he's matured and the pantomime villain is gone now. And we're seeing this Fernando and Lance relationship blossom. But you're rolling your eyes at me already. I can see it.
This is so not the way it's working. I used the term idiot before because I still love this message.
What an idiot.
Soon that'll be about Lance. And it won't be this year because the car's doing well and they're competitive and he's all ham and jam, happy to be here. But I think you could go to every team he's left in flames and you could ask the junior driver or the number two driver, how's your relationship with Fernando? And at the beginning, there's always a bromance. In the first year at Alpine, you could have gone and asked Esteban, said, hey, how's the Fernando really? Oh, fantastic. Do you remember when he won in Hungary? He gave all the credit to Fernando for holding up Lewis. A year later, they couldn't talk to each other. They couldn't go to team meetings.
I know, but everybody matures eventually.
This car Everybody is does. Good.
Just like cheese and fine wine.
Uh-huh. In high school, matures eventually, this is the high school quarterback is a bully. And he found a kid whose dad is rich and has a private jet and will take him to Atlantic City. And so now he's friends with the pimply-faced nerd. But as soon as the jet stops running for him, he's going to turn on him. I promise it's 100%.
Oh, so there's no redemption story for Fernando in your view. He's just a villain to the end.
I don't even think I'd call him a villain. I'd call him a cutthroat competitor. And I respect that.
But
I
just think Seb was. And Seb matured into this like nice guy.
Seb
at the end
had
of his
kids.
Career.
He got into climate change. He got into a lot of things. Fernando's still just a racer.
He matured from... Okay, I think you've been a bit mean
All right,
to Fernando.
So here's the deal. I'll put you a bet, $5. If by next year, halfway through the season, summer break, if Aston Martin has gone backwards, I promise their relationship is crap. I almost use a different word. $5?
Well, no, Fernando's got to be to blame for this. You can't. Correct. Like, let's just say Aston Martin don't do well next year. That might
right,
have
that's
nothing
my point.
To do
then,
with Fernando.
Then he'll come out. Then the true Fernando
okay,
will come
so
out.
So we'll see the nasty side of Fernando.
If the car is good, he'll be happy and smiling. Put me near a podium. I can make this happen. I'll even watch Lance on TV as I drive by corners in Miami and comment on what a nice job he did. But after that, once the car's bad and he's got like an Alpine situation going on, I don't see it sticking around.
I see. I'm a sucker for a redemption story. I'm ready for Fernando to mature into this. Well, you talking of suckers, I was looking at tire stories for you because I know you're a right sucker for tires. But actually, in the end, it hasn't.
How are you blaming it on me that you put this article in the news here?
Well, I saw it and I thought, oh, Brian will be into this. I might as well sleep through it, but I'll copy and paste it in just for Brian. something to do with tires was going to change at Imola this weekend. The most I read into it was actually it was reducing the amount of overall tire sets that they gave in the name of sustainability. So Pirelli not producing as much rubber for the weekend and bringing it down. Beyond that, I didn't really see a lot in there, but that's why I thought I'd throw it over to you. I mean, it looked like the number of softs got slashed in half. So previously, people or teams could have 8 sets of softs, 3 sets of medium, 2 sets of hard. And in Imola, we would have seen 4 sets of soft, 4 sets of medium, 3 sets of hard, which is, what, 13 sets down to 11 sets, right?
Yeah, I think the big news is, and I don't know if you left it for me or just didn't care, but they would have had to use hard tires in Q1, mediums in Q2, and softs in Q3. And that's actually the exciting part to me, is just to see how different cars react. I wish everyone could see Rob's face. That would have been the exciting part for me, is to see how different cars reacted to the different compounds. And, you know, some cars are easier or harder on their tires. They warm them up faster. Rob is officially sleeping. That would have been my favorite part. I don't give a rip about how many sets they give them. I mean, yes, reducing it does.
You
want to
destroy
strategy.
The planet.
Yeah. Yes, I want to destroy the planet. You know what? If you could tell me, bring back V10s, I would. And then I would plaster the top of every facility in solar panels just to balance it out. But give me the
must
V10s.
Be a way. I'm totally off script from what our notes that we're following, but something cropped up on Instagram Reels the other day, which was in the early days of the turbo hybrid era. I believe they piloted a new exhaust to try to give that kind of V10 type of sound to the hybrids, and it was just like this huge funnel sticking off the back of the cars, and it was terrible. It didn't work. Yeah. But surely, right, if we can get AI to conjure up essays or random images just off a prompt, we must be at the level of technology where they can make these cars sound almost V10-ish.
Or, yeah, I mean, they have to rev to 19,000 as well. You
no,
can't
they don't.
Have...
We just need a high-pitched yes. sound. That's all we need,
no.
right? No, you
I
wouldn't know.
Feel the heart of the V10 revving to 19,000 RPMs as it goes around a corner.
19,000 RPMs. If it was 12,000 versus 19,000, you'd have no clue.
That's, yes, you would. Huge difference. Every car person listening right now thinks you're an idiot. No,
if the sound was that high-pitched wail, we would forgive whether it, what I mean is we wouldn't give two hoots if it was 19,000 versus 12, because if it sounded right, like I've watched, we'll get to the video vault later, but dipping into some of like the earlier era cars and you're like, oh man, that sound is so sweet. They must be able to do some modifications to these cars to make them sound like
that.
I
agree a little bit, but the wail that comes is at high revs. You can hear it building through the revs, and that sound from the deep bellowing bass of a V10 up through the RPMs as they build, that wail is from just those
revolutions. I know where it comes from, but given that they put speakers on Teslas to put car sound on an otherwise silent electric car, it can be done, right? So I'm just saying,
now I'm sleeping.
Something.
We're talking about Teslas here. What are we talking about?
No, silent cars that can be made to sound like race cars.
Yeah, BMW puts sound on their cars too. Don't get me started.
Right. While we're saving the planet, AlphaTauri has been given the 3-star environmental accreditation, moving up from the 2-star award that they held. Basically means that they've now reduced a lot of their emissions. They've got green electrical energy. They've got 100% renewable sources to power their facilities in Italy and UK. And the factory in Faenza had 330 solar powers installed, which is all absolutely fantastic. In fact, they also encouraged a bike to work scheme to drop the amount of emissions they're doing. I'm going to be the idiot again with the tinfoil hat on, but they made all these changes to get a great green accreditation, but the car sucks.
That's what we're here for. I didn't know where you were going with that at first, does suck. It's a big box of bolts.
But I'm sure it's nothing to do with their 3-star accreditation. I think it's fantastic they've got it. Is the problem
I
is
agree. Going in the right direction. I like that. I like everybody to be greener if we can, so that we can keep doing these sports like this forever. But man, the car sucks.
Right. So I found this one, and I want to know your view on it, because I stumbled across it and I thought, well, that is a really interesting question. So was it last year Horner said he would rather have a fast car that was inconsistent that he had to make reliable than have a reliable car they had to try and make fast, right? Because he mm-hmm. was throwing some shade at Ferrari being good at the beginning, but he knew the pace was eventually there in the Red Bull. And there's been a lot of swirl at the moment around whether Charles Leclerc has really got what it takes to be a champion. Is he just missing something in his DNA? And what it can, and this question got posed is, can you take the same view and apply it to a driver? Would you rather have a fast, inconsistent driver that you need to teach how to bring a level of consistency to them, or a consistent driver that you need to make faster? Discuss.
That's
so
a
Charles
question.
Right now, for me, is a fast driver that is inconsistent. But inconsistency actually is really, really detrimental in F1, because every time you bin it into a wall and you don't finish, you will score less points than the consistent driver who might not win all the time. But if you podium all the time, that can be much better than being fast but inconsistent.
I mean, that's a great question. I actually think this is a tremendous question. We talked, was it 2 weeks ago, about Charles, Marc, Hervé, Percival Leclerc's pole to win percentage. And it's not fantastic. And a lot of people got back to us and said, hey, you know, the car isn't quite as good as the Red Bull is. And there were a lot of other factors. Agreed. I would much rather have a fast but inconsistent driver who's learning than a consistent but slower driver. I don't want someone who permanently has the
slow button on, slow button on.
I'd rather have somebody who has no slow button and can be Mr. Saturday. He just has to learn how to turn Mr. Saturday into 57, 71, whatever number of laps on Sunday, consistently well done without putting it in the wall at Paul Ricard. And so I would rather have the talent and the ability and work with the maturation process than have somebody who will always be, you know, sixth at best, even in a fast car. I don't know.
I thought I was going to agree with you, but in a startling turn of events, I don't.
So getting rid of Mick and putting Hulk in at Haas, you're okay with that? Because that's the same kind of idea, right?
No. It's not, and I'll explain what I mean. I would say I would rather have a George Russell, who I believe is consistent but needs to work on finding and fine-tuning his pace a little more to really challenge. I think George is going to challenge for a World Drivers' Championship now before Charles does again. Because I just think it's something in Charles's DNA that he is too inconsistent. He won't squash that. And it's great being fast on Saturday. Well, you'll get the pole record. Brilliant. But George, I think, is going to deliver more wins in the long term than Charles is. And I think George is historically a very technically good driver that is consistent.
Yes.
And I think he will get up to speed quicker than Charles will eliminate his inconsistency. And that hurts me to say that as a Ferrari fan, but I do think that's true.
I actually disagree a little bit with the last part of your analysis. I agree George is technically strong and a heck of a driver, and I think he will do well in the rest of his F1 career. But I think Charles is trying to compensate for a car that is great. I think he's trying...
Oh, yeah, because the Merc's a rocket.
I think George is driving within the car, and I think Charles is driving outside of the car, meaning he's trying to get things from it that it doesn't have. and he feels some
pressure.
Because
he's inconsistent and doesn't understand when he's gone past
the limit.
He
needs to learn that he can't single-handedly turn his car into a Red Bull beater. He doesn't know that yet. He thinks, as last year, he could take it to Max.
He's not a rookie, though. You're talking about like he's only just working this stuff out.
I know.
I want Charles to be a champion in Ferrari more than anything that you can think of, right? Because he is the big promise to put the Ferrari back on the top again. But I don't know. Something in my gut tells me it's not going to happen, and we're going to see George do something before.
I'm all in still on Charles. On Chuck. there was a story that Rob found that actually has been big on Twitter the last couple days. I've seen quite a bit. Natural Paradigm, Bryson Sullivan as well. Miami GP not letting a guy in because his camera looked too professional. And so he then got in an argument, and Bryson on Twitter covered a lot of this as well. That iPhone cameras were better than the camera he was holding. And it is in the rules that professional cameras are not allowed at the Miami GP. I don't know where it is, if it's on the ticket or what. So what did he do, Rob, to kind of get around this aspect of the professional-looking camera?
I mean, he went and found, he went old school. He went and found a floppy disk-based camera where each floppy disk could only hold 6 pictures per disk. So he went with a backpack stocked full of floppy disks and just documented the Miami GP through a cheap-ass camera that took floppy disks in. But do you know what? The pictures that he's pulled out are phenomenal. They're not as crisp as it probably would be on the professional, but it's almost got this, 1970s Polaroid quality to it, which actually kind of makes it feel, better somehow. He's come away with a really awesome set of pictures and a great story.
So would you say a talented photographer can make up for a less-than-optimal camera?
No, because the pictures that they were grainy. So, I mean, he couldn't make up for the quality, but he had the consistency of application to be able to put it out the fire.
Mm-hmm. Question. this week's video vault is a short one. I have a couple. Rob has a couple. Really fast. There was a hot lap on the Formula One channel. Lando Norris and Michelle Rodriguez, a fast and furious hot lap. I actually really enjoyed this. It was 3 minutes long. I love the hot laps when they put celebrities in there who freak out. She was cool as a cucumber until the second lap when they went again and Lando really started caning it. And she's like, oh my God. I thought it was fun to see Letty from the Fast and the Furious in there. They actually shared that they don't get anywhere near the car stunts, not even remotely close, but they do a lot of the fighting stuff. And then she looked at Lando and said, have you ever thought about doing any driving in the movies? And I'm like, lady, he makes like $1 bazillion a year being an F1 driver if he needs a side gig.
Cool. If you want to pick somebody up for a Fast and Furious movie that can crash a car real cool, you want to be knocking on Latifi or Mazespin's car. I mean, get them in. They'll be able to do some awesome spins.
Mazespin would be great. Could kind of be the baddie. It'd be fantastic. And then one other one I saw on the Mercedes channel, and I got really excited. You know, everybody knows I cover videos that are either great or terrible. Lewis Hamilton reads mean tweets. In the U.S., and Rob, I don't know if you've seen these, but Jimmy Kimmel does mean tweets every so often where he has celebrities come in, athletes, entertainers, musicians, actors, whatever. And there's usually a theme, and they read mean tweets about themselves and then react. And it's epic bits. They're always fantastic. So I'm thinking, oh man, this is going to be great. They picked out 5 softballs making fun of his outfits lightly.
Oh, it was terrible.
It was terrible. I was hoping for so much more. And again, I'm not trying to be mean to Lewis, but that's the point of mean tweets. You should really make fun of him, not saying, oh, you're too nice. He goes, am I? I'm just an optimist. That's not a mean tweet. And so, I don't know, don't watch it. Just pass up. 2 minutes. We already talked about it longer than the video enough.
Yeah, I wouldn't even bother. And then 2 that I found. So, the Race Channel, 8.5 minutes of analysis on why Mercedes got the current F1 era wrong. It is a bit of a techie nerdy, but it really kind of pulls apart why Mercedes went all in on the no side pods and why they thought it was going to be absolutely spectacular, how it's kind of unraveled and where it went wrong, and why it isn't just a quick fix to kind of go copy paste Red Bull design, let's go. So actually that was a nice 8.5 minutes of kind of unpacking where Mercedes went wrong and why there might be some optimism ahead for the new design that was supposed to come to Imola. We're not sure if it's going to come to Monaco because maybe that's not the best track to unveil it on, so it might skip a race and go to Spain. But it's a good 8.5 minutes. Then I had on the F1 channel 5 minutes of 5 great battles from Imola. So I was looking for Imola content because I was missing the race, and it's just variety of different battles from down the eras. It's got current things with Russell and K-Mag. It's got Senna and Prost. Just some fantastic, fantastic battles. And not to get on a DRS rant again, but, but they had Alonso and Schumacher from back in the day. Alonso in the Renault and Schumacher in the Ferrari. And it goes on for laps. It's spectacular. These two just going back and forth. And Alonso afterwards in the interview, they give a little clip of like, how did you keep Schumacher behind him? He's like, well, I knew he had the faster car. So what I did was every time we got into a corner, I braked a little early into the braking zone to force him to have to back off early. And then I could get the juice down earlier out of the corner. And that's all I could do lap after lap after lap to keep ahead of him. That wouldn't happen in this era. Schumacher would just stay behind him until the finishing straight and then would just whiz past him with DRS. So watching some of these old battles, the Senna-Prost ones, there's a Villeneuve versus somebody else I forget now, as in Gilles Villeneuve, like really going back, and the Schumacher-Alonso ones, those close cat-and-mouse chess games on the track just would not happen in this era right now. And that, go and watch this. It's like 5 minutes long. That's why I don't like DRS.
Well, one thing we didn't actually say out loud, we have on Twitter, but speaking of Imola, obviously we wish everybody in the impacted by the flooding, horrible flooding. You saw it coming as the rain started, and then it just got so bad, and I watched a video of a woman with her child trying to get to safety in a flood. Yeah. And so it's horrible what's happening in central Italy, and we wish everybody impacted safety. Just terrible. Speaking of Imola, but we decided, since we had to pivot, that we would do something we've threatened to do and done tiny bits of over time. We brought out a Veil's Tales, and Rob's going to drive us through a lot of this, but in order to do this right, it's important that we kind of settle in, get the fire started, and say, all right, it's time for today's Veil's Tales about Adrian Newey. We've heard a lot about him recently, and I don't know if you've been as curious about this curiosity of a bald man who walks around the Red Bull paddock as I have. You've heard a lot about his history, but let's learn more about it. So, with this excitement, it's time for Veil's Tales, Adrian Newey.
I'm not sure that is a roaring fire. That actually sounds like we're watching our house burn down, but okay.
I have to pee again. It always makes me have to pee. I don't understand.
Oh my gosh. So just before we jump into this, just because we haven't done one for a while, we did Mansell a while back, but anybody that's not listened to A Veil's Tale, if you imagined when Richard Hammond used to do some nice historical features on the Grand Tour or Top Gear, then it's like that, just a lot less good and professional. But we tried to kind of unpick the history of, so far we've done historical races, but a number of people have said, look, you need to do something on Newey, because everybody keeps going on about Newey and the rocket ship that he's done for Red Bull, but a lot of people don't know a lot of things about him beyond that he's just this Red Bull genius. So we thought we would pick up the gauntlet, pick up the challenge, and use the unfortunate Imola cancellation to do an Adrian Newey's Veil's Tale. So I'm going to start on the biggest thing, which is obviously the best thing.
Come on now.
Adrian Newey was born in the same town as I was.
Same year, too.
Yes, although I hide it a lot better than he does. Stratford-upon-Avon, in the centre of the UK, home of Shakespeare. So Stratford-upon-Avon has given the world Shakespeare, Adrian Newey, and Rob from the Dirty Side. I mean, that is quite a trio. But and for anybody who doesn't know who Adrian Newey is, I mean, you might have just heard his name associated with Red Bull, but I mean, he is the mastermind behind like almost every aerodynamic innovation and design that has been seen in modern times. And actually, kind of, we did a blog on it last year, and I kind of wrote this line to say, actually, that line of modern times needs some context, actually, because he's actually been designing F1 cars since the late 80s, which actually means there's been more F1 run since he's been designing cars than before he was starting designing cars. So actually, it's not really modern times. Newey has been a kind of a constant in the sport since the 80s. So he has designed cars with his little pencil, because apparently he does still use the pencil. He doesn't like all this modern computer rubbish. He likes to get a little pencil out and sketch it out. They've won 198 Grand Prix as of the 2023 Miami Grand Prix. That's an insane number. One guy's cars that, yes, okay, he's not the one driving them, but they will all point to the fact that it's his machinery that allows them to do what they do. 198 Grand Prix.
Amazing.
That's insane.
He literally has written a book, which I still haven't read, How to Build a Car by Adrian Newey. And you often see it in other teams, like in their studies, in their libraries, where they do videos. You can see the corner of the Adrian Newey book in other teams' mobile homes. So he, as you were saying, he's widely regarded as the best designer they've ever seen with his pencil. And the number of people who have won because of are tremendous. I think if I have this right, he was aeronautics and astronautics degree. Is that right, Rob?
Something like that. Yeah, that's where he was. University of Southampton back in 1980. And after graduating with his aeronautics and astronautics degree, he went and joined the Fittipaldi F1 team, wow. Which kind of had to read this properly, because he comes straight out of a university and he goes in there as their chief aerodynamicist. I'm like, really? You get a chief role out straight out as your first gig? I mean, that seems pretty sweet.
I'm sure he had an endless supply of pencils.
Well, I just think it epitomizes the greatness of people that come from Stratford-upon-Avon.
Oh, but, God, more of this.
This might be a recurring theme during this. Then a year later, he moved across to work for the March team and found himself designing cars in their GTP series. He designed a car that was nicknamed the Lobster Claw, and you'd have to go and to Google this, but essentially, it's a car that's got two big protruding claws. It is like a lobster or a crab pincer, right? Which basically grabs the air and directs it underneath the car into the Venturi tunnel. So, a guy that has experience with floor downforce as early as the 80s. I'm wondering if that knowledge will ever come back to help him in future car designs that he works on.
I had not seen the Lobster Claw car until we were doing this research. It is tremendous looking, but as soon as I saw it, I knew immediately there were Venturi tunnels involved.
Oh, yeah, of course you did. Yeah, I mean, you were looking at that and thinking, that is a Venturi tunnel if ever I saw one. I mean,
you know,
yeah,
if he's not building absolutely a double diffuser on the back of this thing, then I don't know what.
So off the success of the Lobster Claw Venturi tunnels, March moved him across to their IndyCar side of things, and he was a designer for True Sports team in 84. And his March 85C design won the 1985 championship and also the Indy 500 that year. So his stock is on the rise big time. And again, maybe we'll have to try and put some pictures out to accompany this. Or if you go back and look at our blog post from last September, we tried to put all the cars in there. But that Indy March car, that yellow car, it's a sweet looking car. Yes. I mean, it's got the world's most ridiculous front wing. It looks like a pencil mustache. But it's the thinnest thing going. I don't even understand why the wing's there, but I'm sure it's Newey genius that decided that you need a pencil mustache to be able to create top speed. I don't know. He then had a spell away from March with Newman Haas, and then teamed up with a certain Ross Brawn at a team called Force F1 that really didn't last for very long, but it actually gave him his way into Formula One. And again, kind of coming back to March again, he was the chief designer of the March 881, which was the first Formula One car he ever designed. It was the fastest normally aspirated car on the grid in 1988. Yeah. But he didn't exactly cover himself in glory in the next few years. I don't think the March years will go down in his memoirs of best cars I designed.
But you learn a lot from maybe not
best
having
learnings
the greatest
are
success.
In failures, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And then he moves on to Williams. And he worked at Williams in the FW14. And at this point, he gets in there, and it's 92, where his car took Williams to both the constructor and the driver's title. And we've actually, quick plug for the Dirty Side Discord. If you're not a member, please join. We've been doing, JP and the crew have really been doing a question of the day. And we've come across a lot of Mansell questions, especially after we did the Veils, Tales, and Mansell, as well as Williams, as well as designers. And my point being, we now know, well, for anyone who doesn't, the 92 season that Mansell had was heroic in terms of the way it worked out. And that was a Newey car. And that was the first time one of his cars in F1 won a title, and it won both. And so it was just tremendous. And then it repeated the feat in 93, the FW15C, but it was Alain Prost behind the wheel, no longer Nigel, who took that title. And then it gets a little kind of squirrely the next couple of years. Rob, I'll let you cover these, but his track record starts to grow.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it goes through a little bit of an unfortunate. I can't even imagine being involved in this, but he was part of a number of people at the Williams team at the time to be charged with manslaughter over Senna's death in 94, because it was kind of being pointed that potentially it could have been the car that was to blame. And, you know, he gets acquitted, but it's just the way that these things in the legal system can kind of drag on for so long. So Senna died in 94. Knew he gets acquitted in December 97. So that's got to be a long, 3 years is a long time to be kind of wondering whether or not you're going to be kind of pulled into this kind of stuff, right? But then the Italian Supreme Court reopened the case, and it went all the way through until 2005 until he was finally fully acquitted. That's 11 years after Senna has passed away that he's kind of got that hanging over him. But you know, in the meantime, he was still actually flying along at the Williams team, but good old, well, I was going to say anybody that's worked in corporate America, but it's not just America, it's the world over, right? Good old politics gets in the way and kind of torpedoes his Williams career. Apparently, he was basically going to be in line for technical director of the team, but Patrick Head was the power player at Williams at the time, and he basically blocked that move. And it feels like it's almost cutting off your nose to spite your face. You've got this amazing designer that's delivered these fantastic cars, but he gets put on gardening leave until 96, where he then is free to join up in 97 with McLaren. I just don't get that, like, there must have been more going on behind the scenes there, that they've obviously clashed over something. There's a power play going on. Patrick Head's won out and knew he wanted it. So off you go, fella.
And then he obviously had amazing success walking right into McLaren with Mika Häkkinen. And so great titles in 98 and 99. We'll talk a little more about those. A small lull in his career at the later stages of McLaren after the Häkkinen years. And then Red Bull came knocking. And it was the beginning of an amazing partnership that has gone off and on. And we saw some steps forward with the RB5 coming in 2009, but really, really hit full stride with Seb 2010 and 4 years in a row of double championships, constructor and driver, 10, 11, 12, 13. It was on the back of new regulations, which saw a blank canvas. Just tremendous opportunity. It was the RB6 of 2010 was utterly dominant. Just tremendous from that point on.
Yeah, and then the RB7, 8, and 9 carried on and won all the titles. I always wonder, did he have to do much? Did he just like copy paste last year's design and tweak here?
What is he doing now? Is his pencil just dull sitting behind his ear? He's like, yeah, the car's good. We're fine. No one can touch us.
Yeah, and I think they would have gone on to dominate. And there's a lot of, you'd see at the moment, like people are saying, like, should the FIA make changes to kind of nerf Red Bull a little bit to allow others to catch up? And I saw a good thread on Reddit the other day where they were kind of saying, like, it's always happened all the way through the eras. Whenever a car has become too dominant, the FIA will always try to, you know, tweak something. Or if there's like one thing, one specific piece of technology that has got a team way ahead of the others, they'll find a way of almost making that illegal so that they've got to get rid of that and start all over again. You know, it happened to Ferrari. It happened to Williams. I'd even go as far as say it's happened to the Mercedes in the past. But I think it's just what happens in F1. You know, if you can see that a set of regs has been interpreted by one team way better than the others, then you've naturally got to try to tune it up, because we all want close racing. But after that kind of 4 years on the spin, there was a bit of a change. They didn't really adapt to it too well. They only had one solitary win in Canada that year, and they announced that Newey would basically no longer be part of the F1 day-to-day team. And that was what we all thought was going to be back in 2014, like Newey stepping away from F1. So he went and moved sideways inside Red Bull organization and became involved in the America's Cup sailing team, which, guess what? This guy seems to be able to design anything that needs to go fast, because it's not like his boat sucked.
I'm actually thinking he's not actually bald. He just knows he's faster. It's more aerodynamic to not have hair.
And then in 2016, they moved him on to be the lead designer he had a venture over in Aston Martin on the Aston Martin Valkyrie project, a joint venture between Aston Martin, Red Bull, and other manufacturers to make the fastest street legal car in the world, and it is an absolute beast when you see the pictures of it. I hadn't even seen this until I was researching this.
Oh, I've actually watched the videos of people driving both of them recently. But wait, did you say this?
This is Valtteri Bottas, and you're listening to the dirty side of the track.
Oh, you said Valkyrie, not Valtteri. I'm sorry. And so... Aston Martin, I had to get it in. The Aston Martin Valkyrie, I saw a lot of videos not that long ago of people driving the Valkyrie and then the AMR Pro, which is utter insanity. They actually the track version, track only of that car, the AMR Pro, it's almost impossible to drive it to the max. Like for your brain to process how fast the car is going and what you need to do to locomote it around a track in that fashion, there are very few people who can actually get the max out of that car. It's that insane.
Yeah, I mean, I saw this stat, and I've got to be honest, I don't really know that much about the Le Mans cars, but the way they put it out there made it sound like it was a big deal. They said that AMR Pro has been referred to as the ultimate hypercar and can do the 8.5-mile Le Mans circuit in 3 minutes 20 seconds, which would put it right up there with the winners of the Le Mans circuit, and they're custom designed just to do that. So this is a street car that has been amped up into the AMR Pro, and it is just it's an absolute beast of a car to look at. It really is. But you know, so there he is, designing boats, designing insane hypercars. You know, anything he gets his pencil out and designs is basically going to go fast. But obviously that's life away from F1. But then in comes 2022 with the new era of regulations. And they blow the dust off Nui's bald head and bring him back over into the F1 camp. And this is an absolute genius stroke, because they know that they've got this guy that was there at the beginning when floor ground force under, you know, the ground effect, Venturi tunnels back in the 80s. He was a pioneer of all of that. And there was an interview that he gave on the Red Bull channel where he said, look, it's a huge regulation change, the biggest one we've seen since 1983 when Venturi cars were banned and the flat bottom came in. So since 83, it's all been this flat bottom stuff. So there we go back to an era where it's the ground effect with the Venturi tunnels. And it just seems like he probably had a piece of paper from 1983 where he could just bring it out of his filing cabinet and go, this is what we need to do, guys.
Yes, I have this designed already.
And I think he did, because, and I know it's easy to play Captain Hindsight or Monday morning quarterback, as you say over here, but it's like, he's designed a car that he probably already knew a lot of the pitfalls that were going to be hit by the new regulations and how to maximize the ground effect. The car was an absolute beast, and they never really, yes, they had some porpoising,
but
they didn't have it anywhere near as bad as the other teams, because he already knew it was, a possibility. He had an interview with the Race magazine, and he said, yeah, we knew it was a potential problem. With these regs, it introduced the possibility of it. But whether or not everybody will be able to see that and how you model for it is going to be the difficulty. Because the genius of this is, and again, I've got no experience or knowledge of this, but apparently it's super hard to observe the porpoising effect in the wind tunnel.
Right.
It's almost impossible to kind of model it, and we have heard it. And so, of course, all these other teams didn't see it in their wind tunnel data. Red Bull didn't see it in their wind tunnel data. But Nui is designing a car going, yeah, I know you're not seeing it on your little fancy computers, but my pencil is telling you it's going to happen, guys.
Well, I mean, and as you say, all these other cars last year when this came out were hit with the porpoising, which we haven't done this in a while. I had to bring that back. But you know what? That meant something. So what that meant was to cut down on the porpoising, where the car gets sucked to the ground, then thrown up and then sucked back down, and that creates the porpoising. They had to raise the ride height. And by raising the ride height, you lose speed and you're worse at cornering. And they didn't have to do that at Red Bull. Adrian had already had a car where he knew he could avoid most of the porpoising, but yet keep the ride height low, keep the car slick in a straight line, but good around the corners with the downforce it generated. They were at a huge competitive advantage. And you said it really well. He's been in F1 more than half the time. More than not, Nui's been around. He has this history. He was successful after a couple failures. He was successful. He learned what worked. He knew the past. He knew ground effect. So it was a tremendous opportunity for Red Bull going into 22 with the Nui car.
Yeah, I agree. And one of the... I I should have picked up the name of the video that I found it on, but there was an analysis of, if you really want to understand the genius of Nui, then you need to watch Spa in 2022, because Spa has got three sectors, and sector one and sector three is where all the speed comes in. So if you're a fast car, you're going to do well. You're probably going to have your purple sectors in one and three. But sector two has got a lot of downforce and a lot of the corners. And essentially, those two different demands of those different types of sectors means you can't dominate both, because you're either going to be fast and then have to kind of hopefully not lose too much in the slower corners, or you're better through the corners and hope to not give away in too much top speed. Spa 2022, the Red Bull dominated all three sectors, which is almost an impossible thing to have pulled off. But Nui's car was not only fast when it needed to be fast, but it was fast through the corners as well. So, I mean, he's just a genius.
You say that, but let's actually put some numbers to it. That was the race, and I may have this wrong, but Max started 14th and won from 14th.
Yes.
I think I got that right. 14th?
I think it was, yeah.
So that, let's put a number to that. Not only was the car tremendous at Spa, it an amazing driver in it brought it from 14th on the grid to first.
Yeah, absolutely insane. I mean, every single car, yeah, other than maybe a couple of little glitches along the way, anything he's put his design pencil to has been absolutely an amazing car. But given, like we said right back at the beginning, that as he graduated from Southampton with an astronautics degree, probably not much of a surprise that he designs rocket ships.
Oh, I thought it was because he was from Stratford-upon-Avon.
No, I was going on this rocket ship joke with the astronautics. That's my little dum-cha. You know, that's...
Nailed it.
Yeah.
So you found some things about him away from F1, which I didn't know any of these. You want to hit a few of these? Because this is where I really appreciated that Adrian is a car nerd, a driver wannabe.
He's an absolute sports car collector, and he drives. He's participated in Le Mans Legends races for a few years. But I do like the fact that he might not be the best driver, but a very lucky bad driver, because he destroyed a Ford GT40 competing back in 2006, but basically only cut his finger. And then he wrecked a Jaguar E-Type at Goodwood and didn't get too many bad injuries either. He then, in 2007, made a move across to the AF Corse Ferrari F430 for the 24 Hours of Le Mans. Nui and his co-drivers, Ben Aucott and Joe Macari, managed to finish 22nd outright and 4th in class.
Wow.
So, you know, got some skills there.
Yeah.
He was also part of him designing the insane car. If anybody's ever played Gran Turismo 5 on the PlayStation, there was that Red Bull concept car that I think was a fan, had a fan on the bottom to basically suck you down to the track.
I don't remember that.
The Red Bull X 2010. It was stupid. You basically never needed to use the brake. You could just hold the accelerator for the entire lap because the thing was just like sucked down to the track by this fan. Yes, that was a hypothetical concept car, but again, Nui had insisted on proper design going into it and saying, look, if you're going to build a fan car, this is how it would work. So, that's pretty cool. Yep. What else we got here?
He had a few other accidents out of the time he was racing. He was in the Ginetta G50 Cup at Snetterton as a guest driver. He spun out and got into an accident with somebody else. He was taken to the hospital. No serious injuries. By the way, he's an officer of the Order of the British Empire in 2012 for service to motorsport. He was announced as an advisory board to the W Series back when the W Series was announced. But here's the question I actually have. He was awarded his own Red Bull RB5 in 2010. Is that right?
Was he?
Yeah, out of regard for his achievement with Red Bull since he joined the team in 2007.
Well,
he first drove the car at Goodwood. And that's pretty darn cool. Now, I wonder, is it like a detuned version, or does he have an actual F1 car of his own? Because I know Charles, I mean, you hear about this happening. He has cars that are sitting with the Prince's collection in Monaco. Not that I'm, all into Charles Leclerc. Anyway.
No, Nui is a Flintstone version. It's got no engine in it. It's just got
maybe it doesn't rev to 19,000.
Oh, man. Do you want to do some sap stats of the Nui career?
Yeah, just a summary, just a few quick ones. But we have an A-team based theme. Last week, we had an amazing Miami Vice, or 2 weeks ago, it's the amazing Miami Vice song that we played, and I made a tremendous video for that you can find on our YouTube. And Andy's been at it again with another banger of a song, this time taking the Miami Vice theme, but to the A-Team. So here we will launch a little longer version.
A-Team to the F1 theme. It's got nothing to do with Miami Vice this time.
No, we shifted it. Miami Vice to A-Team. Sorry, that's what I meant.
Okay.
And so here's the A-Team version of the F1 theme from Andy. I'm going to play a little longer version of it before we get into the stats summary of Adrian Newey.
Find them.
The dirty side already. Andy, that was amazing. So, SAP stats in summary, Adrian Newey. We hit most of it throughout, but he has brought 11 cars to the Constructors' Championship. The 92 Williams, the 93 Williams, the 94 Williams, 96 Williams, 97 Williams, 98 McLaren, 2010, 11, 12, 13 Red Bulls, and then the 2022 Red Bull. Of those 12, 11 also brought the Drivers' Championship. The one that didn't was 94. That was when Schumi won it in the Benetton. But so we had Nigel, we had Alain Prost, Damon Hill. We also had a friend of the pod.
This is Jacques Villeneuve, and you're listening to the Dirty Side of the Track.
And the 97 Williams, Mika, we already talked about, Seb, and Max. And then two were drivers only, Mika Häkkinen in 99, and then Max in 2021.
And I wouldn't bet against adding another two.
I think we got a double coming in. Exactly. We got a double coming in 23, hot on the heels of that. So just a tremendous person in the sort of history being built of Formula One. As you said, and as I'd echoed, you know, more time in it than out of it in terms of the history of F1, and his fingerprint is indelibly left on so many years, so many teams, so many championships. Rob, anything else? You really drove it. It was a really great episode of Fails Tales, so thank you for that.
I'm not sure we've done full justice to the guy because he's just done so much, but it was fun researching him and kind of looking into everything he has done. But actually, I honestly also think that his impact to F1 is way bigger than what we've just listed out, because anecdotally, you know, the green Red Bull, the Aston Martin, probably what Mercedes do to their no side pods. Pick any other car. Any other car has, I won't say copied, but surely you always look to replicate what the fastest car is doing. Right. And for many, many, many years, that fastest car has been an Adrian Newey-based design. So anybody that's come to reclaim that top spot from them, even Mercedes to some degree, I think have always had to look at and say, right, what would Adrian Newey do?
Exactly.
So it's not just what we've listed today of his actual accomplishments. I think the dude is just completely embedded in the whole sport. It was fun looking into him, and 100% he's adding two more titles to his list this year.
Agreed. Rob, thanks, man. Great Vales Tales. One quick note before we hit Monaco preview. Finally, back on track. Literally, the cars and us. Fantasy last week, a listener, Adam, reached out and said, hey, I'm Chicago Gunner, not Herb. So I had made an erroneous attribution of a team who did well, and he actually filed a protest, his third with me in the week. Also did not, but I will correct the record. Good job, Adam. And so we have Monaco. As you listen to this, we are getting ready for Monaco. I like Monaco.
I'm such a hypocrite.
Why?
Because I'm one of the biggest, like, do we need Monaco on the calendar anymore?
Yes.
We want better racing. This is just a procession. But you know what? When we're about to hit race week for Monaco, I'm all in on Monaco again. And I rediscover all that romantic love for it and can't wait to see. And I know it's going to be a procession. And I know we won't see too many overtaking, but I don't care.
You know what? There's a flip to that. I think it's one of the best qualies because of the danger involved in the walls, and we've seen it bite people. I'll talk about Charles in a minute. I love Saturday at Monaco. It is the best hour and 10 minutes you're going to have. Yes, the race not as good as the quali in my mind. I go for the quali.
I could still watch the race. I, even though I watch the race too, I can still enjoy the race, because it will throw up something. It's been around forever. It predates F1 really, because it's been run as a race since 1929. It will no doubt throw up safety cars. Although we said that about Baku, we didn't get a single one. But
and we had no yellows or anything in Miami.
Pretty sure we're going to see safety cars. We're also going to see lots of yachts and celebrities, and more money than any of us could probably even imagine having is all going to be dripping around Monaco. Fans do seem to love it, although it splits opinion, I would say. Although I've just shown that I have a split opinion as well. When we're not in race week and we're not in the romance of Monaco, I'm kind of am on that whole, maybe there are better racing circuits out there. But it's just iconic. I think that's what it is. I think it's just got, like, when you see the aerial shot and you see the marina and you see the overhead shot of the hairpin at the hotel, or the first corner and up the hill with the shot again
coming
of the marina
out of the
in
tunnel.
The background. It's just something special, isn't it? Even if the racing's not brilliant, it doesn't matter. It gets away with it because of everything else that it's got.
Now, it has history and tradition, but there's a race coming up soon.
Vegas, baby! Vegas!
Which I might offer is just redneck Monaco.
We'll see.
Monaco is part of the Triple Crown. That includes the Indy 500 and Le Mans. Graham Hill is the only person to win all three. Montoya and Alonso are active and have won two of the three. Senna tops with 6 wins. Schumi and Graham Hill on 5. Alain Prost on 4. And then current drivers, Hamilton's got 3 wins. Alonso 2. Vettel.
Vettel.
Nice pace there.
Copy and paste error, isn't it? Sorry about that.
Can I read Daniel Ricciardo? Oh, no, wait.
No, don't.
Max
won. Well, he's current. He's reserved.
Yeah, Max won. And Checo, obviously, with last year's when he won and then slipped on his car as he was pumping his fist and fell into the cockpit. That was funny. But talk a little bit about 2022, because it's going to lead into a short Brian's story.
Oh, God.
I'll keep it
okay.
Brief.
So, I mean, actually, despite the fact that it's a procession, last year it gave us a very entertaining race for some times, and especially for Ferrari fans for all the wrong reasons. But anyway, Charles got pole. Sainz was second. Perez was third. Max was fourth. And we had that whole, I don't think we knew it at the time. It's only through hindsight, after Max mentioned it later in the year, that it's kind of come under the focus. But Perez crashed out right before the tunnel and then collected signs as he kind of came around the corner afterwards, which caused a red flag, which stopped the session and denied Max another run at maybe leapfrogging everybody. And now it's kind of, you know, was it on purpose? Did he kind of do that in order to bring the session to an end? God, who knows? Who cares? But so quite an eventful qualifying. On the Sunday morning, I remember this, we were all in the bar waiting for this race to start.
Took forever.
Because it was just raining so hard. But they seemed like they didn't want to give it a run in full wets. Like, we just waited forever and forever and forever and forever. Then they did finally start it in full wets. But I think we had a rolling start behind the safety car, not a standing start. We lasted about 2 laps and we all came back in again. And then thankfully the rain stopped and we got that wonderful thing that Brian always says that he enjoys and so do I, which is that drying track race where that's really going to throw things up in the air.
When are you going to pit?
Yeah, exactly. And that all came into effect here because I think Sainz got double screwed that race, if memory serves me right, because he was left out longer. Everyone else started to come in.
Well,
everybody
didn't he ask to go straight to softs, to slicks?
Maybe he did then, but everyone else came in and went from the full wets to the intermediates because there were back markers that were suddenly lighting up the timing board and putting in great laps, and Sainz stayed out forever. And then we got it was coming into the slicks window. At this point, like it's in the bag. It's in the bag for a Ferrari 1-2. I think it looks like Charles is probably going to win it and Sainz is going to be second. And then when we got to that infamous moment where the slicks were ready, it's when we got the whole Charles. Sainz went in, Leclerc came around the corner. It was pit or box. He came in and they came out and said,
stay out.
And he was already in the pit lane. had the world's worst double stack and managed to undercut themselves, just destroy their own strategy and go from a 1-2 to a like throwing themselves down like in fourth and fifth, I think, as they came out. I think
it's 2-4 is where they finished. 2-4, but
2-4 where they finished. But I think when they came out after that, they dropped below a whole bunch of cars, right? We also had Schumacher splitting his car in half. It looked absolutely terrible, but thankfully he walked away from it fine. But that gave, I think that was red flagged it, wasn't it? They safety card it to start with, and they had to red flag it after that.
Ran out of time, 3-hour limit, so we had 64 laps. I loved the wet part of this race. Pierre Gasly, the gas man, as his friends call him, according to him only, Tripod, he was frisky on the track. He had some overtakes that were just epic. Really courageous overtakes. And then Joe had maybe the radio call of the year coming out of the tunnel. He got on the gas a little early, and the tires just let go. And he had a full-on Fast and Furious drift going where the rear was coming around the front. He saved it, had to cut the chicane coming out of the tunnel. And they said, "Are you all right?" He goes, "Yes, I just need some new pants." And so at that point, I knew we had a very talented young rookie driver with a great sense of humor. I've been a Joe fan ever since. But we also did a video earlier this year about walking the track. Someone did this months ago. We posted it. It was fun. But Rob, you've walked some of the track, yes?
Yes, yeah. I think I said it on last year's episode when we covered Monaco that I was lucky enough to go down there to visit my wife at university. Well, she wasn't my wife at university, but she went down as to part of her degree to study French in the south of France. And I went down and visited for a weekend. We took a weekend in Monaco, and I led us around the city. And she seemed very impressed by my knowledge of downtown Monaco.
There'll be a swimming pool coming up on the right.
No, it wasn't the swimming pool. If you remember, Brian, it was the hotel hairpin that completely rumbled my whole story when I didn't realize that those red and white curbstones are the only thing that kind of stay for the rest of the year. Everything else gets dismantled. You wouldn't even know it's a racetrack. And as he came around that corner and started walking down the hill and she saw the red and white curbstone, she said to me, "You've got us walking the track, haven't you?" Yes.
You're kidding. Until then, it was like she didn't know you were walking the track?
Well, no, because it doesn't even look. I was getting a little confused because when it comes up the hill and goes around the casino, like, that looks like that's the only way you could possibly drive, right? You come up the hill, you turn left, you do a little wiggle, you go right, and then you're down towards the hotel hairpin. Yeah, nothing like that in real life. That's like a whole, like, intersection with about, like, 10 different directions to go when there's no barriers to either side of you.
And when you're 25 minutes into walking through a tunnel with only other people in there wearing Ferrari shirts, I didn't know what direction you were going.
The correct way? Why would I walk the track in reverse?
That's how I drive it in video games because I'm usually pointed the wrong way.
Oh, so anyway, that's that. And now you want to regale us with your man crush, Charles Leclerc, because you've uncovered a few things about it, but I just keep scrolling and I'm not even getting to the end of this. So I'm going to hand over to you.
Well, Charles-Marc Hervé Percival Leclerc, and he is a Monégasque driver. So first off, what does that mean? Has anyone else from Monaco actually run the Monaco GP? He's the fourth. Louis Chiron was the first local driver. Chiron, as anyone who's a car fan, Bugatti has named their most recent hypercar the Chiron after Louis Chiron. First local driver to compete in the race in 1930. So Rob already said this started, what, 29? You said so. So he was in the second year. He was the runner-up. He'd compete again another seven times, and Louis Chiron won in 1931. Again, this is before F1 was a thing. So he won the Monaco GP in 31, and he was, you know, a youngish man at this point, but he kept doing it. He was present for the grid for the event in 50. He qualified in eighth when it was F1. He ended the race in third place, making him the first, and so far, and it pains me to say so far, only Monégasque driver to finish on the podium at his home event. He had another record in 55. His final race appearance, he was the oldest driver to ever compete in F1 Grand Prix at the age of 55. He finished sixth. He made a couple other appearances, but in 56, he had a blown engine and failed to qualify in 58. So the 55 Monaco GP was Chiron's last finish. There were two other Monégasque drivers, not named Leclerc or Chiron, who ran it. André Testut in 1958 and 59. He failed to qualify for the race on both occasions. And then Olivier Beretta drove for LaRousse in 1994. And it was his home race and the first time he reached the end of a Grand Prix, finishing in eighth. Beretta made six more appearances before running out of money. So basically, Louis Chiron, running it in his late 50s or mid-50s, was the only Monégasque to ever finish on a podium. It was his first year doing it in 50. He'd obviously won it before it was an F1 event. So Charles has an opportunity to really make a name for himself. In 2017 is an F2 sensation for Prema. He had two races on the F2 weekend. In the first one, he pitted right as a safety car came out, which was not good, and then had to retire a lap later with a suspension failure. But then in the F2 sprint race, he retired with an electrical issue. So technically, he didn't finish either race in 2017. But he did win the F2 championship by a pretty decent margin. So he's a talented driver.
But nothing to do with Monaco. No. You're talking about Monaco.
No, yeah. Bupkis. He had two shots in 2017, couldn't finish either. I think he technically placed the second one. He had enough laps in, but he didn't drive across the checkered.
You're clutching at straws now.
Oh my God, get ready. It's going to get worse. In 2018, he joins F1 for Sauber, as we all know. He had 1 year at the Sauber team. Late in the race, he had brake issues and runs into the back of Brendan Hartley. I'm assuming Hartley was a Toro Rosso at the team. That was his only ride, right? And they're both out, doesn't finish a race. So he didn't finish either of the F2 races that weekend in 2017, didn't finish in 18. 2019, it's his year, he's with Ferrari when the team was still okay, even with the whole gas situation. Tire gamble and quali failed. He starts 15th, and Charles, as he's still known to do, tried to push too hard, tried to pass Hülkenberg. When Hülkenberg back before he took his hiatus, he hit the wall at Raskas, out. Didn't finish 19 either. 2020, no race because of COVID. 2021, he takes pole. The town goes wild. But as I remember very distinctly because I was freaking out standing in front of my TV cheering. At the end of Q3, he's got pole locked up. He comes around the swimming pool and he loses it and crashes into the wall kind of on the side, front right side of the car, and swings around there. And they didn't know. There was a huge debate. What are they going to do? Can they replace the gearbox? But he didn't want to take a grid penalty. Ferrari didn't want to take a grid penalty. So they didn't change anything that would require a grid penalty. So he still got pole. Sunday, he goes on the formation lap. And the radio, and I don't have it. I know I fell short here. But the radio was epic when he realized his drive shaft was not working. And no, no, no. And he didn't even start. DNS. He's moved his DNFs to DNS at this point. Didn't even start the 2021 race. He did, however, in the spirit of a guy I think is amazing, hang out and cheer on all of his friends. He was like literally in the crowd of people at the start finish line.
Yeah, world champion in the making.
Oh God, please. And then 2022, you already hit it. It was a mess of strategy. He pitted, don't pit, box. No, stay out, too late. I'm sorry. He changed 47 pairs of tires in the rain. He ended up finishing fourth. So as of now, Louis Chiron, the only Monégasque to ever finish on the podium. And I am hoping that Charles will get third this year.
Yeah. Are we going to do, like, we've been trying to make it a thing now that we do predictions, right? So last year, it's going to be difficult to bet against Sergio because he's the street track king. And he won it last year. So I'm going to go first because I put you on the spot last time to go first. So having said that, I think I probably am going to go against my gut there and say that it's still going to be Max followed by Sergio. Now this is the equalizer, the Aston Martin, just because it's quick. It doesn't really matter too much around here as much because you don't really get to play with top speed too much. So I'm going to go out there and I'm going to put a George on the podium.
Are you serious? You're going with third for...
Yes, I am.
And that is regardless of whether they bring the upgrades or not?
Yeah, because even if they bring the upgrades, unless it completely backfires and like acts like an anchor and slows them down, whether or not the top speed is any good or not doesn't matter here. You don't get anywhere near top speed around here. There really are, one straight, and it's not long enough, I don't even think, to hit top speed before you're breaking for corner one and off up the hill. So
yeah.
This is always, I mean, if any track has actually got the ability to have us have a non-Red Bull winner this weekend, it is this one. Especially if, actually, you do your prediction first, and then I'll go down my little...
Sergio is a street track expert. However, let's not forget, he won at Singapore in the rain. He won in Monaco in the rain. He won in Baku when Max's tire exploded. he won in Baku and Max pitted 30 milliseconds before the safety car came out. So I have Max first because Max is a hell of a qualifier. And then once he gets in front, there's no way anyone's passing him in the dry. So I have Max first, Sergio second, and then I have Charles third.
And if I really want to sit
because Mr. Saturday,
totally,
Charles going to put
I was going to say,
yeah.
If we go from the really, really optimistic Ferrari fan view, what my heart wants to say, like it wants to kick my head view from a minute ago in the head and say, right, enough with you. This is the one chance for someone like a Charles that if you can be a Mr. Saturday.
Yes, you can hang
actually,
on to it.
You tend to really, unless you screw the pooch or get bad luck, he should win it from pole.
I don't know if we could pull those. His car's not fast enough. That's my point. I think Red Bull still gets first.
You don't need
one,
speed.
Two.
Speed doesn't matter around Monaco, right? So if Charles can nail it in pole, he gets pole again like he did the year before. Then actually, as long as they don't screw the pooch with a stupid strategy, it's so insanely difficult to pass at Monaco that it doesn't matter how fast. This is the one circuit where DRS means nothing because it's not long enough down that straight to really do anything other than maybe give you a chance up the inside at
turn
one.
They'd still take him
up
the hill. They'd still take him up the hill.
Nah, you wouldn't. The Ferrari's not too bad out of the corners. They don't get a chance to get up to top speed, so the Red Bull doesn't get a chance to reel him in. Where you normally see the overtakes at Monaco are the get a good line out of the hairpin, down through the corner leading into the tunnel, good acceleration through the tunnel, and then you sometimes see some moves at the hairpin down, the chicane, sorry, at the end of the tunnel. So Max could get him there. But yeah, again, like I say, heart talking overhead. If Mr. Saturday Charles turns up and pops his thing on pole, he should be able to fend the Red Bull off at this circuit of all other circuits because speed doesn't matter here.
Max, it doesn't. Checo, Charles.
I mean, that's why I said Max, Checo, George, because my head believes that those guys will be quicker. But this is the circuit where, who knows, Alonso could go and get his 33rd or 4th, whatever it is, win. Because again, speed doesn't matter as much here.
Well, I guess we'll find out. I'm excited for it. As I said, a lot of people like to poo-poo the race, and I agree it's not the best race to watch, but the quali is chef's kiss. Enjoy it on Saturday. Gather around with your friends and family early in the morning here in the U.S. and have some chips and salsa and a beer and watch the quali because it's going to be good.
It is. And looking forward to it. And then we go to Spain.
Yep.
And then after Spain,
a 1 week break, and then.
And then what race is coming next, Brian?
Canada, baby. Thank you, Lynn. We'll explain that in subsequent episodes.
But yes, okay, we can't really look forward to Canada. Well, we can. Me and you can both look forward to Canada. But right now, we have to be laser focused on Monaco. So we will see you all in a week's time. Well, we won't. We'll talk to you. We won't see any of you. This is quite a lonely existence where we just talk into microphones. But
and that's why Rob doesn't do the closing. Have a great week, everybody. Talk to you soon.